From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about eviction-free MKE, a program helping people facing eviction.
Before this project, less than 3% of tenants in eviction cases had legal representation by their side. Now it's closer to about a quarter of all evictions filed.
Then we'll look at the organization Fathers Making Progress and the community it creates for Black Milwaukee fathers.
I was totally disconnected from purpose, but becoming his dad gave me purpose. So becoming a dad literally changed my life and saved my life. Made it my life mission to be somebody for somebody, you know, and that evolved to a life mission of helping others be somebody for somebody.
Plus, we'll speak with one half of the alt-rock duo They Might Be Giants. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll speak with one half of the alt-rock duo They Might Be Giants, ahead of their performances in Milwaukee this weekend. But we'll start with this. Eviction-Free MKE is a three-year pilot program that provides residents facing eviction with free legal representation. The program launched in 2021 after Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley signed a bill establishing the right to counsel in Milwaukee. But the pilot program is set to end at the end of the year without more funding. To learn about the impact the program has had on eviction cases in Milwaukee, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with Legal Aid Society's Executive Director Colleen Foley and United Way's Christina Kohler. They're also joined by an eviction-free MKE attorney, Lillian Cheeseman, to talk about cases.
Colleen, tell me about the mission of this program and the services it provides.
So the program is geared towards individuals facing a live eviction. We have 10 attorneys and two paralegals and an intake specialist and a liaison person who help people get through that process. It's full representation. It's eviction defense in court. As you can imagine, or maybe the audience hasn't had exposure to it, but it's intimidating. It's fast-paced. And when something as sacred as your housing is at issue, to have a trained advocate in court to make sure that you're aware of your rights and your obligations is pretty critical. So, yeah, to date, we've already served over 10,000 households in Milwaukee and moved the dial on representation from what it had been for tenants, which was 3%, to now between 20 and 25%. So it's been, and I don't use this term lightly, it has been a game changer for stability in our community.
Right. And do you also help seal tenant eviction records as part of the services?
We do. And thank you for asking that question, because part of the beauty of this program has been the adjacent successes related to it. The eviction sealing clinics now, we've held one every month since March. We've had anywhere from 50 to 90 people come through the door, and we're going to do those every month. In fact, the next one's July 2nd, in case anyone's interested. But our team meets with individuals in our lobby at 728 North James Level and makes an assessment about whether someone prevailed in their case or whether that was a dismissal or they were the winning party for whatever reason. And we help to get that eviction off their records so that they can find the next safe and affordable home without being impeded by just the pure eviction filing, which doesn't speak to the outcome of the case.
So, Christina, prior to the emergence of eviction legal assistance programs like Eviction Free MKE, how often was it that tenants had legal representation?
That's a good question because, you know, I'm not a lawyer. So coming into this, I realized I had a lot of misperceptions. I think a lot of others perhaps do as well. I thought that everybody, if they couldn't afford legal assistance, they were just granted an attorney in court. And that's definitely not the case. The attorneys in the room are nodding here. For criminal cases, you are given a lawyer because the outcomes of the case are so detrimental to your life. But an eviction is a civil case, and in civil cases, you aren't granted free legal representation. So most of our tenants here in Milwaukee do it alone. They handle their eviction case alone. Before this project, less than 3% of tenants in eviction cases had legal representation by their side. Now it's closer to about a quarter of all evictions filed. And so far, like Colleen had mentioned earlier, it's over 10,000 households we've provided legal representation for.
And Colleen, you were talking about this earlier. Why is attorney representation so important in eviction court?
It's particularly critical because it does move at such a fast pace. And, you know, you're served with a summons and complaint. You are typically in court within a few weeks thereafter. There's a lot of rules and statutes that apply, and it's not always that people even owe money. We've had someone who almost got evicted over a $50 discrepancy in what their rent was supposedly at. But you come into court, there's hundreds of people in there. A lot of individuals default because the process is intimidating. They're rightfully scared. And losing your housing, of course, has an impact on every facet of a family's life, from how their kids do, the stability of a block or a community, employment for a parent, because you have to take time out of your workday and figure out childcare and get into the court and you sit there for hours because it's multiple hearings. And then the damages that are involved also can be thousands and thousands of dollars. If you don't have someone in there with you to help analyze what's happened with your case, calculate whether the information from the landlord is accurate or not about what, if anything, is owed, it's like a train, and it does run people over because, as I said earlier, it's about 13,000 evictions filed every year. It's a huge docket. The court system is processing it. And now has become, much more deliberate about it and questioning, given some of the issues that have been exposed during our tenure on this project. But, frankly, a quarter of the individuals we represent, you know, have indicated that they want to leave their housing. So part of what our project does, too, is provide, you know, a dignified exit strategy, both for the household and for the landlord. And we work with landlords. We've convened two landlord-tenant symposiums because we have a lot of areas for common ground about making sure the system works more efficiently and for the betterment of everyone involved in it. And so we work with tenants to help them understand, again, what their rights and obligations are. And we work hand in glove with the Rental Housing Resource Center in our building. That's a service both for landlords and tenants.
Right, to really help resolve this issue. Christina, what are the most notable results that have come from this program?
Well, the first I'd say is that the default rate has dropped dramatically here in Milwaukee. More than 70% of tenants wouldn't even show up to court before this program was launched. Now that default rate has dropped from 72% to 32%. Some other really impressive results through the Stout research is that 76% of evictions were dismissed, if that was the client's goal. It's also been really effective at sealing records. So over 72% of the Eviction Free MKE clients have had their records sealed, which means that if they're applying for a future rental space, they're more likely to get it. There's not that additional barrier. And we've also seen a huge return on investment in our community. For every dollar that is invested in this program, our community sees a return of about $3. Wow. So within the first 18 months of this project, it had a social return of investment of between $9 and $9.3 million.
Wow. And so, Lillian, you're an attorney with Eviction Free MKE. What's the first or one of the first things you notice when you first connect with your clients? What are they often most concerned about?
Usually they're pretty panicked. They don't know what the eviction process is going to be like. They don't know why their landlord is doing this to them. Most of the time they're trying their best to pay their rent or to do whatever it is to be good tenants. And so a lot of times the first conversations we're having with our clients is listening to their story and letting them process their emotions and how they feel like the world is against them. And we have to get through all of that and get their story before we can, you know, start to dig into the more technical legal questions that are going to form the basis of our defense.
And what are some of the cases that come to mind that you've worked on?
One of the most notable cases that I got to work on was just straight up fraud. My client had actually been able to continue paying rent throughout most of COVID. And towards the end of COVID, she did run into some trouble. So she did the responsible thing. She went to one of the organizations that was distributing the federal funds, and she was applying for rent assistance. And she was told she'd maxed out. She'd never applied before. She'd never gotten any federal assistance. She had no idea what was going on. Well, somebody using a fake email address that looked like it could have been hers, but it wasn't, but somebody had applied for rent assistance in her name. And part of the rent assistance process was you would do an application and then the organization would send an email to your landlord. And your landlord would then file your lease and a ledger showing how far you're behind so that the organization would know how much to pay your landlord, because the money was going directly to landlords. It wasn't going to tenants to then pay. That was supposed to prevent fraud, I think. Well, the landlord's email address was correct on this application. He ended up getting over $13,000 in rent assistance while my client was still paying her rent. So he was getting double. And not only that, but somehow her rent had increased from $750 a month to $800 a month on the application. And he also charged for the late fees. But the rent wasn't late because she was paying this whole time. And so then finally, when she actually does need a little bit of help because she had some hardship and she wanted to apply for the funds, that's when this all came out and she gets rejected and the landlord files an eviction against her. So that was a pretty crazy case. And when we went to trial, this landlord, he didn't show up with any documentation. He didn't have any ledgers. He claimed he didn't know how much money he received in federal assistance for this client. And it was just a really frustrating case. And in the end, I mean, we won the case. My client was able to move. We were able to remove it from her record on CCAP immediately. But this guy got away with at least $10,000 of overpayment of fraudulent money. And as far as I know, he's never been held to task for it. I mean, that's certainly probably the most blatant example of fraud. You know, it's the most egregious one, and it's the easiest one to see.
Thank you for sharing all of that with me first. And so it's almost been 3 years since this program launched. What's next for this program, and will it continue? Colleen.
I think it's fair to say we are working collectively, the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee and United Way, to advance this project and sustain it long term and to bake it into the ecosystem. I'm going to move heaven and earth to sustain it. It's been so impactful to this community. And it's really, at the end of the day, it's really about dignity for individuals who are facing one of the hardest things in their life with their families and making sure they have a legal advocate. And frankly, not trusting that the system is going to work like it should, because it often doesn't. And just having an advocate in court to help individuals understand what they're up against, what their rights and their obligations are, educating them moving forward. And then, again, we've been proactive both with diversion efforts with our ceiling clinics and speaking to a national and local audience about what other entities can learn from what we've done. And I'm hopeful and working hard to ensure we continue this for the community, because it's a really critical service and it makes Milwaukee a better place to live for all of us.
So I wanted to add that this is an incredibly effective program at preventing evictions and homelessness. So we're going to do everything in our power to keep it going for as long as possible. So if this program ends, evictions will go up. People with evictions on their records will be more visible to more landlords out there as well, because those evictions won't be sealed. It'll create more homelessness in the community, more pressure on the homeless system, be more expensive for the community in general to cover those crisis services. I can't think of any good outcomes to this program ending.
Well, Colleen, Christina, and Lillian, thank you all so much for speaking with me today and for sharing more with me about really this impactful project. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you again.
Colleen Foley is the Executive Director of Legal Aid Society Milwaukee. Christina Kohler is United Way's Financial Stability Portfolio Manager. And Lillian Cheeseman is an eviction-free MKE attorney. They all spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. Last Friday, the local organization Fathers Making Progress, or FMP, held their second annual gala. At the event, local dads receive awards for their work as parents and community members.
FMP was founded by Teron Edwards with the goal of improving the community by strengthening fathers with shared experiences. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez was at the gala last week, where he spoke to people involved in FMP and award recipients.
What are you wearing? Because you look fly as hell. Like, can you tell me about this fit that you got going on?
Oh, well, this suit is beautiful. It's actually tailor-made. When I was at the International Fatherhood Summit, and there was a tailor there. It was I'm giving this prize name, Pavic Grover. But anyway, you know, I was sitting there talking to him, and then I was talking about the gala, obviously. And he was like, let me make you a suit.
Teron is in a black-on-black pinstripe suit, tailored cuffs, a real bow tie, he clarifies for me, and a signature fedora. A gala like this was never the goal when he started doing fatherhood work 20 years ago. And that's when he was working in anti-poverty policy. He was working with non-custodial fathers to build a network and a brotherhood beyond just the programming. At least, that's how he pitched it to other fathers, like,
hey man, let's start our dad's group. And I did it just because it was fun. But one thing I quickly noticed was that the guys who were coming to the group were doing better than the guys that weren't. I didn't understand the science behind it at the time, but it was something that I was able to help cultivate and build. And, you know, folks who came for the initial, you know, 12 weeks or whatever of child support forgiveness or a gift card or whatever it was we was offering, they said, hey, that was fine and dandy, but you know what? This is one of the best spaces I have in my life. People listen to me here. This is good. I'm experiencing the growth, and I'm seeing the growth just from the time me being here as opposed to the time I wasn't here. What's next? You know, this is over. Can I come back?
You talk a little bit about the importance of having this here, serving Milwaukee and people in Milwaukee, specifically Black Milwaukee.
One word for you, efficacy. You know, efficacy and just being able to have self-determination in Kujichu Galia, you know, being able to have our own and self-determination and pride, like everything. And you funny, you mentioned, use the words Black Milwaukee. It's like, we're actually in a Black-owned facility that was built for the Black community that celebrates Black art, where we're honoring Black dads. And we have Black dads, an organization, you know, started and ran by a Black dad that's honoring Black dads. Like, this is the epitome of self-determination. And it's important because, you know, we are what we see. And that's why we want to highlight this. It's just like, that's where I just see the value, like people being able to see it.
He says this kind of representation is everything. And that's coming from someone who didn't have it. And he says he could have used it, especially after becoming a father himself at 16.
I mean, every statistic that goes around being a teen father, anything you could think of negative, I was probably into. That's probably what was going on. But it's like, becoming a teen dad makes you really just kind of, well, it should. In my case, I speak for myself. Because of what happened with my father. My father was murdered, you know, when I was a kid. Before I was 10 years old, my dad was gone. You know, it put me in a bad space that kind of led to, you know, some of the things. So anyway, purpose. I was totally disconnected from purpose, you know. Becoming his dad gave me purpose. So becoming a dad literally changed my life and saved my life. You know, that's also the roots of FMP. You know, just, you know, I made it my life mission to be somebody for somebody, you know, and that evolved to a life mission of helping others be somebody for somebody.
The gala wasn't just a night for fathers to get their flowers. There were delicious full plates of catered food, a raffle with prizes, a silent auction, and 6 awards to be handed out. They included Rookie Dad of the Year, Community and Comeback Dad of the Year, and a brand new category, Co-Parents of the Year.
Please welcome the 2024 Co-Parents of the Year, Brother Heal the Hood, Ajimu Butler.
Ajimu Butler, I am the founder of Heal the Hood, Milwaukee. And today, me and my son, Mama, won the Co-Parenting of the Year award, which is prestigious. That's different right there. That's different. I like it. I love it.
So how did this even happen? You know what I mean? Like, so...
Well, usually a man and a woman come together.
I mean, how did you make it work? Because when I think of co-parents, again, I told you, I'm the product of a messy co-parenting situation. Mm-hmm. When people are together, there's feelings, resentment, all of this they got to work through for the little one. But how did you get here to this point with her?
Navigating co-parenting, again, in the earlier stages of parenting, we young, we was dumb, we was just in love, didn't know what we was doing, and the baby was a product thereof. So when we had separated, it was definitely difficult. We bumped heads a little bit, we wasn't communicating for a little bit, and I can't really pinpoint what allowed us to get over that, but once we got over and we saw that the grass was greener on the other side, it was like, oh, shit, this easy. And we are truly friends. We do business together. We get money together. We raise this baby together. We share similar views and belief systems. And that's what makes it easy for us. So I love what we do. I wish I had more of a blueprint or formula that I could give to other co-parents, but we just work.
I think there is a foundation, and I think you mentioned it up there, and that was that you had parents that weren't together, but they made it work.
Preach, black man, preach. That's all I know how to do. That's my mama, y'all. That's like some mama stuff. That's my baby. This is the third. But I want to take a moment to honor my mother and my father, because at 32 years old, I don't think I can ever recall a time where they were in a relationship. They gave to this world two beautiful children, me and my oldest sister, and they nurtured us, they poured unto us, they prayed over us, they made us unto the beings that we are. And so nowadays, for me to be a co-parent with my son, mama, is such an easy flow because I have such a beautiful example thereof. So can we make some noise for my mother and my father who are with me?
Tell me about a time where you saw them, where they were able to make it work for you and your big sister.
They still do that shit to this day. And me and my sister got a joke that they kind of like got a crush on each other or something, because she'll cook a meal, or she's a baker. She'll bake some stuff and then take it to him. He'll cook a meal and drop food off to her. And, you know, just the way that they friendship is just like, okay, y'all. So, I mean, if you talk about, we call it a memory where I watch co-parenting flow. I mean, do we want to talk about something last week, or do we want to talk about something when I was in a little boy? My whole life, I've watched them co-parent to educate us, to integrate us into society. We were always in like martial arts, African drumming, acting class, and they always balanced that out. Now, of course, as a kid, I can't really tell you how it worked or whatever the case, but now as an adult, as a father, I get it. It makes total sense. We come together. We made this life. We want this life to have the best possible life. We want this life to prosper, to be peaceful, to be happy, to laugh. And so we're going to play our roles to nurture that, to foster that. So it's a beautiful thing, man. It's a beautiful thing.
Fathers Making Progress is working on a way to replicate that co-parenting magic. This year, they're starting their inaugural co-parenting class, bringing together parents outside of the courtroom to come up with a co-parenting agreement, one that's recognized by the courts. Danita Graham is a facilitator, therapist, and parent, and she is one of the instructors for the pilot project.
What are the challenges that you've seen from parents, either in your own life or through this program? Like, what gets in the way?
If I'm going to be honest, it's us just being selfish. And I can account for myself being a co-parent. And it was messy. And it was messy because I was frustrated and I was overwhelmed and I was angry. But there were things that I was not communicating. And the way in which I was communicating, my co-parent was not understanding that. And so because of the hurts and ailments of abandonment or just whatever those wounds were, I'm angry. So that means I'm communicating negatively and he can hear that. I'm not speaking to him in a way that I respect and like, let's work on this together. It was more of a dominant, which is a power dynamic. And so that automatically, if I'm looking at myself, that would set me off. Like, who are you talking to? And that's not how you want to communicate with somebody you love. And so what I've seen is that when we are frustrated and overwhelmed, sometimes we forget that we're talking to someone I love. And if we can remember that, we will choose our words wisely. We will push the limits of our discomfort for the safety of the co-parent, of the partner, of the person that I love. And I want to make our relationship dynamic work.
If you're bringing in trauma and other things, like, how did you make that work? How did you get there with someone that you have so much history with and so much mess with?
It was messy as hell. We're going to be honest with it, because this is what we're talking about most times. This is why the program exists. This is why I'm really passionate about it. And seeking to make transformation from within it, because we need to be able to work together. And it was my inability to work with my co-partner that really impacted my life in very traumatic and transformational ways. And it's because those experiences that I'm here and I'm like, no, there's a way for us to get through this if we do these particular things and work together. Now, that number one thing was me accepting accountability for my sh.
I don't like that.
And no.
Absolutely.
And I wasn't for so long, because the reality is, regardless of what was happening in the relationship, I was participating. I was co-contributing to that. So if I was unhappy, if I did not like the behaviors, or if my boundaries were crossed one too many times, it was my responsibility to leave. After I've spoken up about it, I've attempted to work with and communicate through that. And if I was not getting the response that I needed, I should have walked away. But I did not. And because I did not, babies came, more babies came, you know, and then that complicates things. Because now I'm forcing myself to work with someone long-term for short-term pleasure.
If you have just a parting message for people that are just getting started on the work to figure out how the hell to do this, What would you say to folks that are like in that mess and trying to like even figure out how to coexist, let alone co-parents?
I would first start with taking inventory within myself, taking some time, separating, whether that's journaling, whether that's listening to some things just to clarify how I'm feeling and what I'm thinking. What do I disapprove of? What is really the problem in this relationship? Is it something that I'm contributing or doing? Is it something, some end result that I'm not receiving? But if I document these things, then it can be clear. After I'm looking at that, okay, what can I control? Control those things. If it's me, I really need to regulate myself because he escalates when I escalate, and like recognize that and own it. Because if I fix everything that I could possibly fix, I know that I'm giving my best effort in this dynamic. Now, once I reach the point that I'm giving my best effort and I'm still not yielding the results, now it's time for maybe some new boundaries. It's not me at this point. I've done everything that I know how to do. So if that's communication, because sometimes, a lot of times, what breaks down in relationship dynamics is one person may be a more direct and forward communicated while one is passive, and that can cause confusion and misinterpretation. And so a breakdown. And so if we work towards each other, that only comes after working within myself. I can only give as far as I've grown to love within me. And remember that you're talking to someone you love, you once loved. And that is really the foundation, seeing the love.
That was Teron Edwards, Danita Graham, and Ajamu Butler. They spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the dynamic work of the alt-rock band They Might Be Giants. But first, we'll speak with the director of the documentary Marky in Milwaukee, which is showing this weekend as part of Milwaukee Film's Pride Weekend. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A 7-foot-tall fundamentalist Baptist and former minister, Marky Wenzel made the decision at age 46 to come out as a transgender woman and start living as female. This decision estranged her from family, led to a dismissal from her church, and a loss of community. The documentary Marky in Milwaukee is about how Marky put the pieces of her life back together and worked toward her goal of sexual reassignment surgery. Matt Kliegman is the filmmaker who shares Marky's journey and will be in Milwaukee this weekend for a screening of the documentary. Ahead of that, he joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
So let's start at the beginning. How did you first meet Marky and start a relationship that led to 10 years of filmmaking to capture her life?
Yeah, wow. So I live in Brooklyn. I was in Wisconsin visiting my folks for the summer, and I saw Marky working at the airport, and I've never had this feeling, but I felt a hand kind of guide me and be like, you need to get to know who this person was. And, you know, thinking back about this moment, I think about all the time, why did it happen, or what appealed about Marky? Marky was very tall. She looked distressed. I couldn't exactly read her gender identity at the moment, but I was like, oh, this is exactly the person I've been looking for. And I was in film school at the time, or finishing film school, and we were really into non-actors and working with non-trained actors for films and stuff. So my original idea was to make fiction films with Marky. And of course that didn't pan out, but then I didn't say anything to Marky when I saw her. And then on a subsequent trip, I was looking for her. And I was going up to all the TSA agents and say, hey, there's someone that works here. They're very tall. And they're like, oh, Marky. Okay. And they passed my info along. And then, like a week or so later, Marky called me and I was like, hey, next time I'm in town, let's meet up. And, you know, the rest is sort of history. I will say A lot of people don't like when you approach them and you're like, hey, I'd love to put you in movies. Like that sets off everyone's red flags, really. But Marky was someone who spent a lot of her life sharing her story and, you know, talking about herself. She was a preacher and a lot of the content was autobiographical and her challenges, and was always documenting her life in one way or another. So it was just kind of a perfect match.
Yeah, so you were kind of working with the material she had already been collecting for herself. But how did you form a good relationship? Because Marky obviously shares some tremendous vulnerability with you and for audiences. So how did you foster the relationship the two of you had?
Sure. So I think it may be possible Marky had just never met someone like me, kind of a liberal Jewish. It may have just been like a little unexpected, but you know, basically we filmed for about a year, maybe, you know, a dozen or so days. And really it was, I was calling it screen test kind of. We went to the grocery, we went to Lambeau Field, we went to State Fair. We just did all this very Wisconsin stuff. And I didn't ask of the heavy content we get into, none of it came up, which was kind of by choice. After about a year, Marky was like, well, I don't know if you know this, but here's some of the details of my life. And I think she enjoyed the process of just being able to talk openly. And, you know, here's someone who's, I come in with no judgment. I don't have the judgments from either her Christian religious community or judgments from, you know, kind of the LGBTQ community, which was a little challenging for Marky, just being an evangelical. It was kind of hard to win friends. So by me being kind of in neither of these parts of her life, I was like a third option, something different. And I think that was refreshing, maybe. And, you know, once we were spending all this time, it became friendly and we found all these other things we had in common. And she really wanted to share the story. And I kind of was, you know, supportive and along for the ride. And then in 2013, Marky began steps of detransition. Marky wanted to talk about these challenges, it felt. And, you know, it was just a privilege to be there and to help her find the words to communicate it and bring it to an audience.
This film shows the complexities of transgender people's stories. And with Marky, you see her struggle so much. And it's hard to watch someone struggle, even as a viewer who doesn't have a personal connection to Marky. So what kind of emotions did you go through filming her as she kind of fought to find her place and be authentic in so many different spaces?
You know, I've one of the ways I related to Marky was that she was somewhat of an outsider, just even within the community that welcomed her. And I'd always kind of related to that. And that was the enduring connection that I related to. Not everyone fits in to a neat box. And it feels maybe there's been a push for people within their identities to be very absolute about that. And it's something that I've personally bristled against. And there's that complexity, and Marky embodied that. And it was difficult, watching people try to force her to be something. But I love that she was this Marky. It's hard to watch someone you know struggle. And, you know, she was always incredibly optimistic most of the time, despite all this. The issue wasn't Marky. The issue was the world that just couldn't make Marky the hero she deserves to be.
One quote from the documentary is, "We've shot enough Marky in Milwaukee to know that I don't quit." And I think this encompasses a lot of Marky's character. So what do you hope audiences take away from spending time with her throughout this film?
You know, and I'm curious, I'm looking forward to watching the film and seeing what it feels like, but Marky's just a different generation. And I think young trans people today have a totally different world of resources and information and influence to pull from. And, you know, Marky was getting, she had one or two clippings from a newspaper she found about Renee Richards, the tennis player. there were limited transgender leaders or people who have succeeded and live positive lives. But, you know, Marky's perseverance is incredible. And, like, I think anyone going through specifically transitioning with a family in a community that's not supportive is hell. And, you know, hopefully seeing what Marky went through, you can be like, wow, if Marky could do it, I can do it. And of course, there's people whose situations can be much harder than Marky's and some different, but here's someone who had, you know, a lot of the deck stacked against them and being able to find success and peace in an authentic life for themselves. And hopefully, I would love if it could lead, you know, to further acceptance and people perhaps evolving their POV on how to let every part of yourself live authentically.
So Marky has since passed away recently within this last year, and the screening of Marky in Milwaukee is kind of an encore tribute to the documentary Marky in Milwaukee that was screened a few years back when it was completed. And with thinking about Marky in this manner, what were your favorite aspects about your relationship with her beyond director and subject? And is there anything you want to share about her from the time you released the documentary to her recent passing?
I had hoped the completion of the film would have set Marky up for, you know, further opportunities, the autobiography, or, you know, talk about a sequel a little. And we, you know, stayed in touch as friends, you know, and it's sad, and many people have said this before, but you hear the news and then you're just like, oh man, why didn't I make the time? Because we were going to try to get lunch. It is a sad regret I have, but it's just so hard and sad that now, like, think, you know, I'll hear about something and my instinct still is to pick up the phone and text her. You know, of all the people that have passed in my life, Marky is definitely the hardest one to accept. And also, I found out about the Marky's passing from a cousin, and I didn't have any info beyond that. I didn't know any. There's no info about a funeral or anything. And, you know, my attempts to be involved in the funeral, attend the funeral, weren't fruitful. And so it's a very unresolved feeling, if you will.
Sure.
And I think the purpose of screening and then, you know, just getting people together is to, you know, hopefully have a moment where people in the community around Marky could get together. And I always thought, you know, Marky was an angel in disguise or something, some, you know, heavenly visitor. And, you know, people who didn't see that failed the test.
Well, you did a great job of capturing Marky and in all of her 7-foot big personality glory. And I thank you for the opportunity to watch the film and to talk about it just behind the scenes a bit, and Marky herself. So, Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. It was very therapeutic.
Matt Kliegman is the director of the documentary Marky in Milwaukee. The film will be playing at the Oriental Theater on the evening of June 23rd, with the director in attendance. Kliegman joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll speak with one half of the alt-rock duo, They Might Be Giants, ahead of their shows in Milwaukee this weekend. That's coming up next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. They Might Be Giants is headed to Milwaukee this week for shows this Friday and Saturday at the Pabst Theater. The legendary duo has been performing together for more than 40 years and have been considered a vital part of the DIY music scene since their founding in 1982. Ahead of their show in Milwaukee, we're chatting with one half of the group, John Flansburg. John, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Nice.
I'm not sure if you're going to remember this, but your song, Dr. Worm, was featured on a show called Kablam in about 2000, where it promptly got lodged in my brain. So I would sing it on and off around my house for years. And finally, one day, I was talking to my mom and I said, oh, yeah, you know, I love They Might Be Giants. They're a great band. And my family was very confused and they informed me they thought I had written that song.
Oh.
And they had been very impressed by me for years. So you helped me disappoint my parents when I was a teenager.
Well, we've been disappointing parents for a very long time. That's adorable. What a sweet story. It's really too bad that your cover got blown. Yeah, no, I remember doing stuff with Kablam. I remember those conversations. We did work for hire for them. We actually did some incidental music, and that was actually some of the very first stuff we did for outside clients. And soon we were working in advertising and doing stuff for network TV and getting bossed around by all sorts of people. So in a way, I sort of think of that time myself as this big sort of moment of change for us.
I actually want to get back to that in just a minute, but I'd like to ask kind of about the roots of They Might Be Giants. I know the name is a kind of roundabout reference to Don Quixote, which is considered to be the first modern novel. They Might Be Giants is one of the earliest bands that comes to my mind when I think of like the early DIY scene. What was that like starting out in DIY back in the 80s?
Oh, well, it's an interesting distinction to talk about DIY, which sort of grew into what we now call alternative rock. And musically, a lot of the bands that were coming out of college towns and big cities in the 80s, they didn't necessarily have that much to do with one another musically. It was really where they played. So it was really defined by the venue. Naming your band is like the first thing you do. Like you don't really have much idea of like how it's going to work. It's the name of a movie. We just named ourselves after a movie. And the actual reference to Don Quixote was something I've never sort of ashamed to say I never read Don Quixote. So I don't really know what the full reference means within the book. I don't think it's direct, but it was the name of a very strange movie. And that seems interesting enough.
Yeah. It's a reference to, well, kind of the windmills.
Yes. Yeah.
So starting in the 80s in New York City, what was the scene like?
The scene was very strange. There was a musical movement called No Wave, which was this sort of post-punk way of performing that was very, very screamy. You know, basically their sound was just this blast of dissonant yelling. So we ended up playing in a lot of places that weren't doing that kind of thing. We ended up playing in a lot of clubs that were featuring performance art, and we would be the musical act in the performance art spot. And that seemed to suit us a little bit better. And they were also just in need of acts. There just weren't that many people coming through. So we would play almost every week in these clubs for crowds of, 50 or 75 people. And it was just it was very exciting, but it was a microscopic scene.
They Might Be Giants does have a feeling of performance art. When you look back at the many things that you've done, one that's that pops to mind would be Dial a Song. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, we played for a couple of years, I guess, or a year or so in New York City, and we had gotten to that crucial point where our friends were no longer coming to the shows, but people who we didn't know were coming to the shows, which is actually kind of an exciting moment. Like you're getting airborne as a band when you have a reputation that's sort of outside of your circle of friends. And right at that moment, I had my apartment broken into and they stole almost everything I owned, except for a tape recorder and a box of tapes. John Linnell was working as a bike messenger and had a bike accident and broke his wrist. So we knew we weren't going to be performing for at least a few months. And I think we were afraid we were going to lose momentum professionally. It was like we had finally achieved something with this band. So we thought, let's do this thing we had talked about just in the abstract, which is buy a phone machine, which was a brand new device. I mean, think about when, you know, the iPhone came into your life. Like, having a phone machine was an emerging technology at this moment. So I went to Crazy Eddie and bought a phone machine with an unlimited outgoing message. And we started recording, just making different cassettes and loading them into the machine and advertising it on the back page of the Village Voice, which was like the community bulletin board for like oddball things, you know. And people started calling almost right away. And it was just like another way for people to hear our songs. And it was a great way to sort of initiate people into the music of They Might Be Giants, because you didn't even know what kind of project it was. Like, you didn't know what the visual was. You didn't know what anything about it. It was just an experience. So it was a great way for people to find out about us.
Now, kind of with that in mind, you guys have been involved in a lot of things. We talked a little bit about it at the top with Kablam, but I was struck looking through kind of your Wikipedia page and your resume. There are so many interesting turns your careers have collectively taken. Can you talk about some of the most interesting things you've worked on? It's everything from like Blue's Clues to a Dunkin' Donuts campaign.
We worked with Dunkin' Donuts for a couple of years. We actually ended up doing something like 25 TV commercials and probably a couple dozen radio commercials with them. So we did many, many work for hire jobs with them. You know, some of it looks more circuitous on paper. But, you know, at a certain point when we got off Elektra, our major label, we were on Elektra for 10 years. And when that deal ended, we were trying to figure out ways of not being on the road quite so much, but we also didn't want to go broke. So we started doing this work for hire stuff right around the year 2000. That led to all sorts of things. Like, immediately the phone started ringing when we made ourselves available for this stuff. Some of it was just like being in advertising. You know, we got hired because we could make music. Like, our name wasn't going to be on it. We weren't going to be professionally associated with it any more than just the music we were making. So we did music for news programs. For the ABC network, we did stuff for their news division. That was one of the big early jobs we had. And they were just kind of making fake John Williams orchestral cues. And I think we did a pretty good job with it. And that was actually what led us to doing all the incidental music for The Daily Show. That was a big break because a lot of people noticed the music and noticed that it was us. And I should say that actually the theme that we did a number of different iterations of, the ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, was actually written by Bob Mould from Husker Du, the band from Minneapolis. And, you know, it was a very hard rock and, you know, a really great band. But I think people would be very surprised to hear that it was Bob Mould or us, for that matter. Yeah, we did a lot. We just did a lot of incidental stuff, and it just led to a lot of unusual clients and a lot of unusual opportunities, some of which were very easy to achieve, and some of which were harder work, and some of which never saw the light of day.
Now, you are headed to the lovely city of Milwaukee right here. What's your favorite memory of Milwaukee?
Wow. You know, I mean, I have a lot of different memories of Milwaukee, but they're all from early days, and they're all slightly catastrophic. The thing that happened to us in Milwaukee that people still talk about is we did a show at the Majeska Theater in the mid-90s where a bunch of people, probably like 20 people, jumped up on stage and started dancing on the thrust of the stage. There was a bunch of staging that was built over an old orchestra pit, and they were dancing so hard that the staging collapsed, and they were sort of sent down like a half story or more, like, you know, 10 feet down into the orchestra pit. And there was a huge cloud of dust, and it just looked like a really strange magic trick the way they disappeared, because they literally just went poof in a cloud of dust. And we were playing the song The Famous Polka, so it was just a very notable and strange event. And then some people got sent to the hospital just to make sure they were okay, but nobody was actually seriously injured at all. So fortunately, I think the statute of limitations has run out, so I can no longer be held liable for any injury. So I'm happy to tell the story again.
So you're the reason the Majesca is closed.
Oh, I hope not. I mean, I felt like we were keeping it open at the time. You know, it was a great venue and it was a great evening. And I'm really glad we actually got to do a whole show there. It was not something that stopped the show even. So, I think for a lot of people, they were just, I actually went to the hospital that night, went to the emergency room to meet the people who had been taken there. And I think their only regret was that they didn't get to see the rest of the show.
John, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect. We are very much looking forward to having you here in Milwaukee.
Well, Joy, thanks for inviting us on. And, tell your family that, you know, you were putting your own spin on that song, that Dr. Worm song. It goes real different if you hear our version.
I will let them know. John Flansburgh is one half of the band They Might Be Giants, which is in Milwaukee this week with shows on Friday and Saturday at the Pabst Theater. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll explore the state and local gun laws that could have an impact on safety during the upcoming Republican National Convention. Plus, Bubbler Talk looks into what happened to the Museum of Yesteryear that was once in an old house in Milwaukee. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say. People just liked it better that way. So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time.